And good afternoon, brethren and sisters. It's indeed a pleasure to be here and to partake in the spiritual blessings as well as the enjoyments that we have while we're here and being able to meet people of like precious faith and spend time with them and meet new people. It's a good time and I'm really enjoying it. The chapter I have to deal with is a short chapter, so my talk probably will be a little shorter than some of the others and probably miss out quite a few things, so I'm going to be expecting that the brethren will be able to pick up and fill in where I've missed out. I'd like to mention those that have gone before. They've all done a really good job, and especially Brother Lenny, I think, really laid a good foundation for us and kind of setting the stage for this study. It's a study that I'm enjoying. It's not something of a technical nature. I tried to see if there were any spiritual significances, but in a way they're all spiritual, but as far as types and so forth, and I wasn't able to find anything, and I'm not saying there aren't, but I would say this, that the literal words here are absolutely profound, because they're dealing with the issues of life. And what could be more profound than that? So I think they're really important, and also I think they're also a very, very, it's a very spiritual study. This chapter then follows the theme that we've become familiar with in the study of Ecclesiastes, in that it emphasizes the vanity of this life when considered outside God's purpose with mankind. So we're talking about, you know, the 70 years versus possibility of eternity. The preacher, Solomon, has had opportunity to try all kinds of things that many of us might desire to do, but we just don't have the resources at our disposal that he had, and he actually was able to do a lot of the things that we only dream about. And because God endowed Solomon with wisdom, he was able to see the end result of all kinds of things, which most of us don't really get to see. We get a little bit, and then we're out of resources and out of time. So Solomon was able to do some of the mighty works and the things that were absolutely desirable, and impressed, in fact, the nations around him with the works that he did. So he certainly did excel in what he did. I think it's important to recognize that Solomon was not saying that we should be so overwhelmed with the vanity of this life that we might as well give up. We should never bother putting out any effort to try anything or go for anything. But what he is saying is that we must see it for what it really is: temporary and for the present only. The benefit is only for the present. It is useful and necessary. We have to have food and raiment, but we should be there with content. Verses 1 and 2, and I've kind of grouped these together as I thought the subject matter in them hopefully fits together. Verses 1 and 2 says, "There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is common among men, A man to whom God hath given riches, wealth, and honor, so that he wanteth nothing for his soul of all that he desireth, yet God giveth him not power to eat thereof, but a stranger eateth it. This is vanity and an evil disease. What I think these verses are saying is that he's pointing out the inequity of a person who faithfully and with great effort builds a nest egg and then becomes sick and dies prematurely, perhaps, so that he does not have the opportunity to enjoy of the fruits of his labor. And then the inheritance, to add insult to injury, the inheritance passes to someone unknown to him, or someone who doesn't even know him, doesn't even really know where this came from. This is indeed an evil. Verses 3 through 5 I put together. If a man beget 100 children and live many years, so that the days of his years be many and his soul be not filled with good, and also that he have no burial, I say that an untimely birth is better than he. For he cometh in with vanity and departeth in darkness, and his name shall be covered with darkness. Moreover, he hath not seen the sun nor known anything. This hath more rest than the other. And this here, again, this is my effort at putting it into our words or deciphering the meaning. It differs only a little from the first example, except in this case he is not blessed with comforts as the one man or person in verse 1 and 2. He works hard, has many children, lives a long time, but ends up not being cared for or about. And also then he compares that with a child who is born but dies, I think, immediately at birth. And he's saying, really, that child is better off than one who goes through all this sorrow and travail and then passes away and is not appreciated. This also is an evil end, not to be desired. This Bible indicates that verse 6 is a new thought, but I really don't think it is, and I've opted to say that it really should have been included with verses 3, 4, and 5. And perhaps it's just to emphasize the point that it's put this way. It is unlikely that anyone would have 100 children, unless it is referring to children or grandchildren and great-grandchildren, which it may well be, as the Scriptures quite often does. And we know it is not possible that one should live 1,000 years, let alone 2,000. So I believe this is the language of hyperbole, and I hope that's the right term. But giving an extreme example to emphasize the point. Verses 7 and 8 I put together. All the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not filled. For what hath the wise more than the fool? What hath the poor that knoweth to walk before the living? These verses, in fact, prove to be very true. It is a fact that in most cases we tend to spend what we earn, and I think, as Brother Glendon mentioned that already, whether we earn little or much. In most cases, our appetite, not just for food and drink, by the way, gobble up what we think we have available to spend. And again, in most cases, we are still not completely satisfied with what we have at the moment. In this way, the thought of verse 8 proves true, that whether we are in the class of the fool or the wise, the poor or the rich, all tends to balance out and cancel out in the end, because we can only consume so much of anything. The rest is really just window dressing. verse 9 and 10. Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the desire. This is also vanity and vexation of spirit. That which hath been is named already, and it is known that it is man. Neither may he contend with him that is mightier than he. Here Solomon, I believe, states what we have all experienced. Whether our desire has been a simple thing, such as, you know, our favorite kind of food, or greater possessions, such as a beautiful property, home, vehicle, or whatever, we wish and wish for whatever it is until the moment when we gain possession of that envied object, you know, get the keys. And then we feel great satisfaction and pride and enjoyment in it. But if we are never able to decide or settle on what we want in the first place, we are in a constant state of longing and wishing. And we know that there's no fulfillment to that. The verse 10 I found to be a little more difficult to understand, and I've made an attempt at it. Maybe we can have some discussion around it. It seems to me that the first part of the sentence should be separated from the part which follows the comma. In other words, that which hath been is named already. It's kind of a statement by itself. It should be perhaps a period. The first phrase seems to say that there really is nothing new that has not been named already by someone, even though the name they use might be quite different than the name that we would use, and therefore we don't recognize it. The rest of the sentence might be included with the remainder of the verse, which may be saying that man does indeed know what we are like. And as Jesus said, or as was said of Jesus, he needed not that any should tell him what was in man. And therefore, we cannot contend with one who is mightier, and I believe it's a reference to Yahweh himself. Verses 11 and 12. Seeing there be many things that increase vanity, what is man the better? For who knoweth what is good for man in this life, all the days of his vain life, which he spendeth as a shadow? For who can tell a man what shall be after him under the sun? This, it would seem, is an ode to the vanity of life. And it is asking why we would desire to add to the vanity that is already there, and in which we all share, more or less, equally, regardless of our position. Solomon almost seems to throw his hands up in a lament as to the futility of life. But I think we should not take it that the question has no good answers, because I think he proceeds to answer the question in part in the first few verses of chapter 7, which we'll hear about tomorrow. I don't believe even that is the final answer. You know, is that your final answer? I don't think so, because I believe that the ultimate conclusion and answer is posed at the end of the book, which we shall see. I wanted to end up with a personal anecdote, which I think sums it up all very well. And I'm sure that you all probably know of situations like this. This is just my own. It's a true story, and some of you may even recognize the character involved. But I think it's a very present-day demonstration of what Solomon was talking about. There was a man who was a very close neighbor to us when I was a boy, and he had built up a very nice farm for his day and age. He owned about double the amount of land that an average farm for that day would have been. He had also built up a herd of purebred cattle that were indeed his pride and joy. He built up a beautiful yard surrounded by hand-planted trees, which was quite a luxury for us on the prairies, if any of you have ever been there. He had also built a log house, which was far better than many for that day, and a hip roof barn, with many outbuildings, including a good well, complete with a windmill. And again, that's another luxury which you're probably familiar with in this part of the world. He was known and respected in the community as a good neighbor to one and all. As he grew older, he could no longer farm the land or tend to the horses and cattle by himself, and so eventually was forced to move to an old folks' home in the city. His homestead fell into disrepair and lay abandoned for many years. He eventually fell asleep in death a few years later. His land was sold to neighbors and changed hands a few times until it finally ended up being purchased by the Canadian government as part of a treaty entitlement program to give to the Aboriginal peoples for shortfalls in past programs. As part of that deal, all buildings and fixtures had to be destroyed by burning or removal. And as it happens, I have ended up farming that same land. This spring, while working the field, I took a few minutes and walked into the yard site to have a look and a moment of reflection. The buildings are all gone. The well is stopped. And there are no traces of what was once there, except for the trees that were planted. If I had not known where things used to be, there would have been no clue as to what had been. The neighbors have mostly changed, so that today, if one spoke of this man, many of the neighbors would have no idea of who you were talking about. His relatives have moved on and probably hardly remember him. He had no wife or children. All that remains is a gravestone and a few notes in a history book. Now, this is not a special case or an isolated one. I'm sure that we all know of people who we have known and have disappeared almost without a trace. But this is my personal reminder of the vanity of this life. There is, however, one huge difference in this particular case. This man had become a baptized believer of the gospel. He had faithfully supported my grandfather in a young and sometimes difficult ecclesia. While we don't know what the end result for him will be, we do look forward with some confidence to the return of our Lord Jesus and to our reuniting with him then. While hardly anything remains physically of him and his works, I cannot sum it up any more appropriately than to quote from one of the hymns that we sing. Those characters shall firm remain, our everlasting trust, when gems and monuments and crowns have moldered into dust.